The House Subcommittee on Finances, the budget for the University of Alaska. The University of Alaska will not be here today to testify. They said that they're, I was told that there's a conference and they're dealing with the very questions that we're getting information on. So the point here is for us to kind of just get up to speed to see what, you know, so that we understand better what they bring us. And, you know, as we heard last night again, this year is about the budget, or if it's not about the budget, it's about the budget, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, all these things have policy ramifications, and this is huge. If you add University of Alaska budget to the K-12 budget, you got something there that is massive. So I really appreciate the committee coming and hearing this information. I appreciate Representative Wilson, chair of the subcommittee, and she's going to come up here and join us as if we want for discussion later, or you can just stay there whatever you like. But with that, if you would introduce yourself and tell us what you got for us.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Representative Keller. For the record, my name is Representative Wilson. I represent District 3, North Pole.
For the record, Matt Greening, staff to Representative Tammy Wilson.
And as the chair has already said, I am the chair for the University on Finance, and we spent a lot of the interim just looking at different options of how we could have the same or better services than we have before we start looking at cutting services. And so this presentation is two-part. The first part is about consolidation. We use the state of Georgia as a background. They have just taken chunks of their university, not the whole system, because as you know, Georgia's just a little bit bigger population-wise than Alaska is, but it did give us a really good framework that we were able to look at and see if this would be a possibility. I have sat in finance for many years, and I have heard the university sit in front of us and say they are one university. By consolidating, they truly would be one university. They would still have more than one campus, but we would actually be looking at the concept of one university, having basically the same catalog, being able to transfer your classes because they would all have the same course number. And I don't know about your constituents, but that's been pretty much the number one complaint that I have received, is they have taken courses and then had problems transferring or losing credits because of the differences in our universities as they are now.
Okay. Forgive me, I'm going to interrupt. I didn't take roll. Representative Josephson is here, Representative Seaton, Representative Drummond, Representative Talrico, and Representative Wolf, and Representative Christ Tompkins. I am myself, Representative Keller. Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. So the following presentation outlines our proposal for streamlining and consolidating the university's overall structure, including services, coursework, positions, and many other aspects, while at the same time providing a better educational experience for Alaskans who are seeking to obtain certificates, training, or degrees. Lastly, but certainly not least, we outline how this process would result in a large amount of tangible, quantifiable, as well as potential savings for the state of Alaska. Simply making cuts will not eliminate our deficit, which leaves us with two choices: wait and pray that oil prices will soar to $113 per barrel, or continue to make cuts and budget responsibly in combination with changing the current structure of the university. If oil prices do return to levels above $113 per barrel, responsible budget cuts and consolidation in unison will leave the state on a much better footing to better educate Alaskans, as well as achieve a sustainable, balanced budget now and in the future. So what this does right here, this outlines what we currently have. So as I was saying before, we have three regional university centers. We have the University of Alaska Anchorage, Southeast, and Fairbanks. And then we have another layer over that, which is referred to as the UA system. You'll see underneath each one of those are the campuses that go along with that. So under Anchorage, you have Kenai, Peninsula College, Kodiak, Mat-Su, Prince William Sound. Under the University of Alaska Southeast, you have Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka. And with Fairbanks, you have Bristol Bay, Chukchi, Fairbanks, Interior Aleutians, Kuskokwim, Northwest, and Community and Technical College. UAF also has a College of Rural and Community Development. So as you see, we have a lot of buildings in a lot of places. And this doesn't include, we also have in other places in which they just have more like e-learning on it, and they may rent a spot, but these are actual campuses at this point. So opportunities of consolidation for the three regional university system. It creates unified pathways to obtain degrees and certificates, providing a clear and concise direction. Strengthens and unifies academic departments to provide program opportunities across Alaska while increasing department efficiency and student service. Creates a modern university that balances access, research, and public service, which goes right back to their mission statement as we have that.
Representative Wilson, do you want us to interrupt and make this a discussion type format, or would you like to give us the whole picture and then come back?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be better if people have questions. I know how I am in finance. If I can ask them right then, it seems
okay.
to have a better
so
impact.
So the committee heard that. Feel free to catch my eye and we'll
And as you'll see, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to read all this. I'm assuming most of you know how to read. So I'm going to just kind of hit the bold points and then, you know, something, you know, we want to have more discussion on it, we can go back to those things. So how could consolidation be done? And again, we use Georgia, who has just previously done it, and kind of took their framework and looked at how the University of Alaska was. So the purpose of campus consolidation is to decrease the system's overall effectiveness in creating more educated Alaskans. Later in the slides, you'll see we'll have a slide in there where they'll talk about graduation rates, not just overall, but with each one of the campuses. Process must be transparent and directly involve all shareholders. So, you know, this is not something you're going to do in a month or so. You're going to want to bring the campus together. You're going to want to bring residents together, students together. The more that participate in it, the better product that you will end up with. Leadership for the
actually, Representative Josephson.
Questions to ask. Thank you.
No,
through the chair. If you said this can't be done in a month or so, are you suggesting this would not be part of the budget? The budget would force it likely to be done swiftly, unless you're staggering some process.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Good point. It would be staggering. There, you'll see later in the presentation that there are. Efficiencies that we can do right now, which has a lot to do with duplication that is going on. But if you wanted to actually have the consolidation program and have one catalog and get everybody together, it would be most likely at least a year process to put everyone together and have it in there. But as far as other efficiencies we can find, and you'll see in some other slides, we have a lot of duplication going on through the state through a lot of our training programs. We are competing as a state for a very small amount of population, and we're kind of spreading them very thin. And if we would start doing that to start with, is to combine those together, we'd find efficiencies immediately. But as far as consolidation, having one university, that would take a little bit longer. But the subcommittee, and just so you know, this is just kind of to catch your interest. We are going to be delving into this a lot more into the subcommittee.
Thank you.
Level.
And just for the record, a comment on that. Maybe somebody else has one too, but that's the nature of the predicament we're in. We have a budget that we're dealing with that's based on revenue streams that don't exist. They're proposed, and there's many proposed things, and we are all committed, I think everybody I've talked to really looking for ways to reform and make things work. So who knows, maybe this will inspire a great piece of maybe a first start or whatever. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are definitely looking to be inspirational. So form institutional implementation committee during consolidation process. So as you'll see, it's trying to involve, you know, everyone from those who are actually working at the university to those who attended or even currently attending and those in the community. So the five guiding principles of consolidation: increase opportunities to raise education attainment levels, avoid duplication of academic programs while optimizing access to instruction, create potential for economies of scale and scope, enhance economic development across Alaska, and streamline administrative services while improving service level and quality. So what we've done here is we've just kind of broken down the increased opportunities to raise education attainment levels by standardizing programs, clear and concise degree pathways, and enhance e-learning. Build on existing collaborations, strengthen and unify academic departments to provide program opportunities while increasing the efficiency and student service. For me, I think, you know, the number one that we expect the university to do is to train our children. And not just to train our children, but then follow and make sure that they're getting jobs, be able to shift in such a manner to where if there's openings for jobs, for instance, mining has a lot of out-of-state workers that come. We know the oil fields the same way. We're wanting the university to be able to train and fill those holes with Alaskans.
Sure. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. when we're talking about
create clear and concise degree pathways, are we talking about eliminating multiple pathways? In other words, a good example might be teacher education, where the University of Alaska Southeast has a program that brings people in for a summer program, and then they go out for a full year teacher training, mentorship, and then they get a master's of teaching after a full year in the classroom, et cetera. University of Alaska Fairbanks and Anchorage have a different program, less time in the classroom, more time in the academic classrooms, more classes there over a longer period of time, and less time in the classroom. So are you talking about eliminating those dual pathways that have been created in those different hubs, or are you I'm not quite sure what create clear and concise degree pathways. Does that eliminate some of those pathways, or does it just put them all available everywhere?
Well, I think for the reaches, it is actually asking whether or not we should have, and teacher is a great example, do we have it in all three universities? There are only so many great instructors in any field, and the more that we spread it out, to me, it waters down the degree versus if you have, you know, if I want to be a teacher, you're going to want to go to, let's say, Southeast, because they have a number one program, versus three programs that are all different, but not necessarily maybe number one, because, you know, you're spreading the classes out much thinner. I think the other thing that we do when we have more campuses throughout the state, I think there's a benefit when you have a classroom of 25 from all across Alaska versus maybe just from Fairbanks, because you also have a campus in Nome and a campus in Bethel and in Ketchikan and Juneau. And if you look at a lot of universities in the lower 48, they may have five or six universities that in their state, but each one is known for a very specific, some of the top topics that they have. So I do think you end up eliminating some of them, but I think the reaches need to look and see which ones, first of all, are working, how many are graduating, how many are getting jobs, are we filling the holes that Alaska needs? But I think the biggest thing on the clear and concise is also having, again, one catalog where you can start your training anywhere you want to while you're still maybe even making the decision on what you want to do the rest of your life, and you're not kind of stuck at that one university. Now I've changed my path, but I'm now invested in, you know, 30 or 45 credit hours that may or may not transfer to one of the other universities.
Follow up? Just following up, I guess what I get a little concerned about on when we do some of these things is that the University of Alaska Southeast is for somebody that already has a degree and it's a master's program that has a pathway that's done in 1 year, and the other universities have a pathway that is for people that want to go into teaching in as they go through their undergraduate degrees and those then. So I just want to make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying might not be all teaching education, all teacher degrees will come out of University of Alaska Southeast, as and all engineering degrees will come out of University of Alaska Anchorage. Is that what we're talking about or not what we're talking about?
To the Chair, Representative Seaton, first of all, those are for the regions. These are just ideas that have done on others. Depending upon what the funding levels are, it may get down to where we're not competing for the same programs in every one of the universities we have right now. It may be that there's enough population of Alaskans that say that we do need in two areas. And I think that's part of having those committees set up and having a range of stakeholders in there to find out why you would have two different programs, and maybe the outcome is the same, but one may be a one-year program where the others are three. Maybe we don't need a three-year. Maybe the one-year pathway, we're getting more teachers out, they're getting out and they're teaching sooner and may be doing better in the field. We haven't had a lot of that comparison with the university because they've kind of been silos. You have three universities all doing all their own work, having their own chancellor, their own, you know, pretty much we have three universities doing their own work without doing a whole lot of interchanging. Not that they're not doing some, but not as much as I feel that they could be doing. But, you know, it's kind of, you want to put as much on the table as you can so these things can be discussed and flushed out and come up with the best program at the end of the day.
Representative Josephson has a question, but before we get there, I want to ask, like I say, I have very little information about what the university conference is about that's going on right now. But I understand that it was noticed quite some time ago, and that it was on the plans and the travel plans and all that kind of stuff. So do you know what information they have? Do they have this? I mean, are they considering consolidation? Do you have any way of knowing that? Do they have your information? Same source, or please help me just understand.
Mr. Chair, you know, we've been working on this for the last few months. I do have a copy now. That will be the first meeting we will have in the subcommittee, is getting their response, find out where they are, you know, in their process, and whether or not they think any of this would work for them.
Okay, so
this is kind of just putting out there so we can start the discussion, and hopefully not just through our subcommittee, but some of this may take legislation as well. Most of it they can do, the university regions have the ability to do. The question is, how long can we wait to be making changes? And I would rather see changes in this fashion versus having less service for our students.
Sure. But I was just giving a context. We start talking about clear degree pathways, you know. I just was really wondering if that's specifically under consideration. I think I heard you say there's no way, we don't know, we'll find out, and the idea is on the table now, you know, for us to pursue.
Well, Mr. Chairman, they have been looking at all their programs for the last year or two, and some of them they have already been combining some of those. I don't know where they've done it from university to university, but I know they have done it within their university, like UAF. They've done a lot of combination. They've dropped some of the courses in which they didn't have enough within it. So they have done, from within the silos, I know they've done a lot. I don't know how much they've done across the board at this point.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize, but you know I have great passion for the university as well.
You absolutely do, Representative Josephson.
And I applaud, at first blush, and I know you're 5 minutes in, and you have my apology for that, but I applaud the idea of looking at treating the university system, if we can, as one institution in terms of credit, portability, and that sort of thing. But are we going to find that you looked at a couple key issues? For example, what do we know? We heard about pulling, and that's sort of an odd word sometimes to use in the building, but it was used by the Rasmussen Foundation, and so I'll use it as well. Do we know anything about the public's position on giving up some of its hard-earned revenue for a university system that offers more courses broadly across the state? Do we have any information on that sort of thing?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph said, no, I do not have that.
Okay.
And I think that's, you know, what I'm doing right now is just walking you through what the process would look like.
Okay.
They may put a committee together, the regents, mm-hmm. and that is part of the process of what are you willing to pay for? How much is condensing, you know, how much of it does it work? How much do you actually lose service versus gain service? We're very unique here in Alaska in which, you know, we have not just a diversity of students that come in, but of levels, free education. We have the geography portion of it. But I think what we have to look at this point, because of the funding level, is that sometimes when you go to the university, you have to pack your bags and you have to move away from home. And that's hard to do for any of the parents there. And so that's kind of another part of it, is that you're going to have to look at all the universities and find out how much is teaching going on at those universities, how much of it's e-learning, and we just have a building that's doing the e-learning, asking the question of why is the university have a building there versus utilizing the high school and making sure that they have more capabilities, because we hear a lot about the internet and some of that sharing going along. So what this does is hopefully just starts the conversation of saying we need to share a lot more.
And just a quick follow-up, and I appreciate that, and I understand the need to have a suitcase handy for an 18-year-old. Did you look at a 25-year-old wife of two children in Ketchikan whose husband grew up there and is gainfully employed, who has a passion to be a teacher and could be a great one, and like to do that training in Ketchikan? Is that sort of thing considered, or is your position that the regents would take into account those factors?
Through Chair Rector Joseph, that is such an awesome question. I have asked the university for years at this point. We have what's known as paraprofessionals in our school. A lot of times we refer to them as aides. They are those in the community who are participating in the school, not just assistant teachers, but in some areas, in the hard-to-find areas, they're actually teaching. And I've asked the university to come up with a program in which it's not necessarily a four-year teaching program, because those great people, they are, if you've ever watched them teach, have probably more knowledge, classroom knowledge, than any book learning could get them. But they still need help on techniques and those kinds of things. And you can do those through e-learning. And I think that's what you'll see in the presentation, that through e-learning, we don't necessarily have to have a campus there, but it will still give that opportunity for those who have jobs in other places to be able to take advantage of that. I think you'll see that there's a lot of places that have got more and more away from that traditional sit in the classroom, do your full 4 years, because one, college is very expensive, and many people have to keep their day jobs. So how do we change and we make it easier for e-learning to happen, whether that's going my own way, you know, and doing it on my own speed, or they also now have where you can click into the classroom at any time and feel like you're participating in the classroom. There's a lot of ideas, and I think it's hard to break out of those shells sometimes because we're comfortable utilizing that system that's been in place for hundreds of years. So I think you definitely have to have both.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, and so moving on, and I'm going to have my trustee Aide explain this wonderful chart.
For the record, again, Matt Greening, staff to Representative Tanner Wilson. What you see here is the chart is comparing the e-learning versus traditional learning in FY15 and FY14. And it's a little busy, and it does it in a horizontal fashion, which is kind of unusual. But you can see that in the clear bars is the FY14 e-learning, and in the solid blue bar is the FY15 e-learning. And on the other side, you have the proportion of both those same years in clear and in green of the traditional learning that went on. And basically what the chart shows is that while a few areas have grown in e-learning from year to year, some of them have dropped quite a bit, and we'd like to see the trend move the other direction in an effort to basically save on overall operational costs and to facilitate the type of programs that Representative Josephson is referring to where you can gain a degree and have the clear and concise pathway to get there and also do it online. And I do have some information on what constitutes e-learning and what constitutes traditional, if you want an explanation of that.
Can you explain a little bit? I look at the two things up there jump out at me. One is Matt Sue and the other is Chuck Shee. But both those circumstances looks like from 14 to 15 have gone more to e-learning. And as Sarah Welton will tell you, our school board member out here, that makes me proud of the Matsu because, you know, we do look that way. But what's the driver there in Chukchi? I mean, why is there such a noticeable increase in trend?
I am not positive on the answer to that, Mr. Chairman. I would note that Chukchi has very few students, so a shift of several students would result in a large percentage change. And I can follow up on that and get that information to you.
Oh, no, that's all right. That completely makes sense.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are, like you pointed out, there are some great successes on the slide, and there's some that, you know, aren't so great. But ultimately, we'd like to see all the different campuses, you know, gain in their utilization of e-learning.
And I just, that was in context, but I do want to thank Sarah for coming down to Juneau from the Matsu, and thanks for being here this morning. So.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add, too, is that I don't know how much you watch TV, but there are others who are competing for our students. And especially in e-learning, of saying not just that you can stay in your own home and do it, but also pressing on that if you have a job in your field, will also allow you to have credit there. So you don't necessarily have to have another university within the state to still be competing for your children.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
It's okay.
I was just wanting on this chart to know University of Alaska Southeast. I don't think that's on there, or is that just...
It is on there. For some reason, it got cut off.
Okay.
I'm not sure how that happened, but okay. I'll provide you with the additional information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, well, first question was just answered about the Southeast. Interior Alaska is on here. I don't know what, is that a campus?
I not 100% positive on this, sorry, through the chair, but I believe it encompasses, some satellites. It is a campus, but I believe it also includes the two satellites, but I will have to check on that to
okay.
get the specifics.
So these bars have nothing to do with student size or population. It's just proportion. So if there's 10 students and, like we said earlier, if six of them go to e-learning, then that bar will move quite a bit, whereas if you have 5,000 students and 100 of them move, the bar won't move at all, correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. And one additional thing I would like to note is that, I mean, this tries to just give us an idea of what's going on. There are, especially in the smaller schools, like you mentioned, a lot of it can have to do with just a particular type of enrollment. But I think it does show a trend, which is the important part of the slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess an overall question about the consolidation that we're discussing. Is this more focused on these sort of smaller satellite campuses and trying to make those less redundant? Or obviously Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau have large campuses. There's going to be redundancy in programs. So for example, if I want to study civil engineering and I live in Fairbanks, I wouldn't necessarily want to have to move to Anchorage to do so, especially if I have a job already or I'm interning at a Fairbanks company or I have a family up there. So I'm assuming that a lot of these programs will remain available at large campuses. For example, we just built two engineering buildings, so I hope none of those programs are going to be canceled because of this consolidation. But is this consolidation more focused on, you know, these outer ancillary campuses and less so on the larger urban centers? Would that be fair to say, or what's your analysis on that?
Through the chair, Representative Bull, it's really about the system in itself. It's back to making it a system, you know, where you would then adjust the programs themselves would depend upon the population and how many wanted to participate. Let's say engineering, you know, that's one that where we hire a lot of engineers. There's a lot of students in it. You could do the numbers and find out that you probably don't make money on students. But we've always heard that you can't put enough tuition or charge enough tuition to really make that come out profitable, but enough to where, you know, you can make it work. But let's say you have something else where you only have 5 students in it. To try to have a whole program where you only have 5 students that are registering at, you know, for the next 2 years to have all the professors you would need to do, likelihood you wouldn't have that. But let's say you have 5 in one place, 15 in another, and another 10. Now you have enough for a major. You just couldn't necessarily do it just at one campus. And again, that's why you have these focus groups, so that you have the university's already done the first part, which to me is kind of the easier part, taking away some of the, and it's never easy, but as far as determining, if I only have 1 or 2 students, a lot of those degrees have gone away, and hopefully it's also been adjusted that maybe through e-learning and others, maybe they could go through the University of Washington or somewhere to where they don't necessarily be here. But to say we're just going to have only 1 degree at each campus only, I think that's unrealistic if we have the population to go with it. At the end of the day, the university is for education, but it's also a business and has to be run that direction. But to say we're just looking to shut down smaller campuses, I think they also play a big role. The question is, are they playing a big enough role in, you know, is it mostly e-learning that they're doing already and we're having a building there and heating it and doing all that, when in reality they're on the computer most of the time, and they could have been doing that within the high school or the community center, and we'd be saving money that way while still providing the service. And it's really going down to that level and looking at it. Thank you.
If I might interject one thing. Through the chair, Representative Wall, Representative Josephson, to kind of further respond to your question, I apologize for the University of Alaska Southeast not being on there, but I have seen the numbers, and they are a campus that utilizes e-learning very well. A lot of their programs work through distance learning and e-learning, and the numbers are pretty high. So I will get that information to you.
Representative Tallarico has some information on Interior, and then Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I know some of the remote sites are located in District 6, and Yukon Flats has a site in Fort Yukon. I think that's referred to as Yukon Flats, Nenana, McGrath, Tok. I even think the Aleutian Pribilof site is included in that, which probably doesn't necessarily fit with Interior Alaska so much, but those are the sites I believe where that, and most of that is operated, I believe, out of the Geist Road, the building they have on Geist Road. So that's kind of the central location to run those centers.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, we'll make sure that we get the list of those. This came off the website for the university, so I'm sure we can get the more details, and we'll see if we can find some numbers also so that you can see whether or not we're talking large numbers, or maybe we're talking a school that only has four or five, and one person was doing it the year before, and four people, you know, did it, so that you kind of get a, percentages can be a little bit deceiving.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the policy question that we're assuming here is that e-learning is good and we should shift to e-learning. And personally, I need to become more comfortable with that assumption that e-learning is more effective learning for Alaskans. And some of these changes, whether you're Chuck Chi or Matt Su or Kenai, you know, oftentimes we have a short-term certificate program offered that may be offered by e-learning, and that could totally shift what's happening, but it's really not a full degree, not a two-year degree or anything. So I think this e-learning component, you know, I'm in favor of giving students options to progress as fast as they can, but we need to know not just what's being offered or how, what percentage is being offered, but what is, what accomplishment that is. It, you know, we could be giving a whole lot of medical refresher courses or something like that, and e-learning, boy, great thing. Everybody goes on there, does their CPR online, and it looks like, oh, gee, the campuses shift tremendously to e-learning because 45 people took this course by e-learning, but you don't have to offer it every year. So I hope as we go through this, we get the distinction. I mean, because I don't know what the distinction is, but we figure out what classes and what degrees or certificates are best accentuated by e-learning and what are necessarily or are better done in person. So I'm not degrading this at all. I'm just saying that for a policy reason, I don't want to make the assumption that the university needs to move, the further it moves to e-learning and becomes a totally online university is a great thing. I don't know that that's what Alaskans want. So,
just for context, if I could, with the sledgehammer we have as the legislature, we'd have a very hard time putting in a policy that put e-learning in place. Just for the record, you know, the budget that goes to the University of Alaska is a block budget. And so your comments on e-learning are very helpful, and that's exactly why we're having this meeting, so we can interact on these issues and that the university can hear us. It encourages me that the university is working on these things, and I know they are. I mean, they have to be. I mean, MOOCs is changing the scope, or has, you know, and it's very controversial. Free online courses that are now accredited through some of the major universities in the United States of America. So we, to keep up with that, you know, we need to have policy discussions for sure. But in a very real sense, we're dependent on the Board of Regents, and we are dependent on influencing them on how to spend the money that we give them. And that's why we're here, you know. So I don't think Representative Wilson is proposing legislation that would push the university to e-learning. But it's a given presumption. Less money, and they have to take efficient. That's one they're hoping. And I know they are. Talk to the regions part of the process. University of Alaska has actually led the way on a lot of the e-learning, distance learning things. When I first came to Alaska and finished up my teaching certificate, I'm trying to remember the date, but it was the 80s, I think, early 80s that I'd been here a while. But they had a good e-learning program then, you know. I mean, it just then it's been growing. And so, yeah, so thanks for your comments, but I just wanted to give a context to why we're doing this again, you know, just to remind you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might briefly respond to that.
Sure.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe one aspect to your question is that we see e-learning as a necessary component of consolidation too. As programs are duplicated, programs are scaled back, as we try to consolidate functions and buildings essentially, and all the structure of the university, we see e-learning as a component of being able to facilitate that in a manner that is cost effective. And also we will have in our presentation to our subcommittee, we'll have some information and regarding basically the benefits of e-learning, the cost analysis between that and regular traditional coursework, and I'd be happy to provide that to you.
Great. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, these are ideas. This is not a criticism of the university. This is just saying there are other ways that we can do business, and we should be looking at all, you know, options, especially if it's going to provide a better opportunity. What I want to remind you is, you know, I have children that are in their 20s, and they spend much more time in front of the computer in hours that I don't spend time there. You know, they're using things being flashed at them, doing things at 1 o'clock in the morning versus, you know, we're all up doing our business 7 a.m. What e-learning does is allows, you know, more opportunity for those who learn that way to have that choice. But there are also children that prefer, students that prefer to be in the classroom. They like that participation, having that classroom back and forth. But they're also having more classes, and some of the high schools here in some of the rural areas are participating in ones where you're doing it on the computer. It's kind of almost halfway between traditional and e-learning, because you see the teacher, you're responding to the teacher, you're actually able to respond to the students. So you have this in some of the classrooms throughout the state that only have maybe 12 high school students, and they've combined with another school, and they're literally, instead of having someone standing in front of them, they have them on the computer, but they're able to also participate. So e-learning has grown in what we used to see it, where so you grab your books, you kind of sit at home, do your own thing, put your work in, and wait for a response back. It's become much more interactive, and again, get back to that broadband issue as well, which is some of my concern, is that we have universities in the area that they have broadband for their usage, but not necessarily, you know, for our K-12 program, and we're paying for it twice versus maybe it would be lower cost for better service because we're all using the same one. So again, you know, this is just suggestions, trying to put them out there to see if we can't do what we're doing better and for less dollars when we're looking at the economic times that we are. So again, we're avoiding education and academic programs by optimizing access to instruction, determine needs and availability of programs. This is the important part right now, is that we literally have to have these committees to go in and say, what are we offering? How many are taking the course? From where are they coming? How many are out of state? How many are not right there? You know, how many are graduating? You'll see in later slides we have some issues there. Review existing program overlaps and duplications to obtain savings, and investigate potential partners, like collaborating with Department of Labor training programs. ABTEC, which is a training school, is in the Department of Labor. It's not in the university system yet. It provides some of the same types of classes as the university does. You know, are there duplications even within that and some other training schools? We're going to go through these pretty quick. I'm not going to read through these. These are just an example of the small amount of duplication that we've seen. But as you see, they go on for a long time. We're not saying they're good, bad programs. We're just saying that takes a lot of instruction, takes overhead to go along with it. And are there other ways? We also have private schools as well as public schools within them. And so we just kind of want to let you know what's out there.
Yes. Representative Olson?
I guess you know what's coming is.
I don't know that these institutions all do the same thing. I mean, we have a lot of buildings
too, but we need
to spread them out so we can all have two. Right? I mean, I don't know if that works. I'd have to think that through, what I just said. But basically, for example, private versus public institutions.
What is the point of that descriptor? What, I mean, I know there are private institutions, but I mean, it strikes me that the only thing that can be gleaned from that is maybe we just don't need that public campus because someone can do this privately. Is that the at greater cost probably?
Is it? The point really is that do we need all this duplication? And first of all, again, you're going to have to review and find out, you know, why, you know, just looking at this and you have OSHA passes, you got 10-hour construction and outreach. You know, I'm sure for each one of those is a reason. One of them is in Palmer, a couple more in Anchorage. But the question of cost goes to, should government, and I'm so glad you asked this question, be competing with private, you know, secondary schools? You know, if the private industry can pay for it, if the unions can pay for the training of it, you know, should we go into those areas? What is the role of the university and all the training schools? And not just what the role is, then how much should we be putting into it as government, into these entities that are competing directly with the private entities. We're not competing as much as it seems like, but I think we are. And I think what that does is that it spreads our money again thinner into areas that we don't necessarily need to be in. And we might be concentrating on those that may not be as economical, but we need those jobs here because Alaska and the waters and some of the jobs that are very specialized in Alaska, we still need to make a little training for them. But I mean, just look at these. I mean, it's just all over. You're going to absolutely have to look and say, first of all, are they exactly the same program? That's the first thing you have to ask yourself. And if not, why not? You know, and then you're going to have to look, and it's so much about statistics of looking who's graduating, and once they graduate, where are they going, where are they getting jobs, and where still are the holes in Alaska labor in which we're not filling with Alaskans, but we're going out and hiring them. When I was trying to get here to Juneau, my plane got canceled. It's not because we didn't have pilots, so we do have pilots. But I was on the van to the hotel with a group of those going to Unalaska to get on a ship to go fishing. Guess where they were from? Not here. They were from Seattle. Now, are they from Seattle because the boat happens to be there and they all came because that's where the boat's from? Or is it because we're not training those to be able to take those positions? We didn't have that kind of conversation because they're kind of a different kind of move. But we don't know. And same thing in mining. We hear this from those who sit on the Department of Labor. They'll bring to us every year of where our deficiencies are. You know, why are we not filling those? Because it's not just about training. It's about training so they get a job and they stay here and work. That's
important. Just one other follow-up, if I may. Some of this, for example, the different types of nurse practitioners. Senator Geisel has a bill that would create the advanced practice registered nurse. And so, although the medical field is more complicated than ever, because I don't know, if I'm meeting with a provider, what these titles mean and what they can do and can't do, and it's very complicated for the consumer, but that's the trend, is that there's all these different initials and degrees. Should we not be doing what Senator Geisel's proposing and not be sort of splintering and specializing and severing these categories? Is that sort of what's considered here?
To the chair, Representative Joseph, again, a university that can shift to where we need the jobs, we absolutely should shift. But if we're putting a lot of, let's say we're putting a lot of elementary teachers out and only 25% of them get a job and the other 75% end up going to Oregon to get a job. I mean, we can't talk them out of being an elementary teacher, nor necessarily should we. But if, let's say we have special education teachers in which we're very short of those teachers, you know, those are the kinds of discussion I would hope the university would have with students, because it's about graduating them into a degree in which they can work. What I would hope is that the committees that are put together would look at, and you would have health professionals on that committee to say, where are our gaps at? Where are we short? Where do we have too many? How can we shift so that we can fill these up? And that's kind of an ever-changing university that you need to have in today's age. So if there's an area that we are not filling because the education is not there, we absolutely should see how we can make that happen. But again, it's going to be about to, are only two or three students going to sign up for the class? Are you going to have, you know, full classes, 10 or 15? And I think that's somewhat where we've missed the boat, where we try to kind of have a degree for whatever anybody ever wants to be. That sounds good, and I know we've had the talk whether or not we should have a law school here in Alaska. Do we have enough students to be able to pay for something like that, or is it better to, you know, there's just some things we're not going to be able to do. The WICHE program and the WAMI are two good examples of where it made more sense to have a combination with another university versus having something of our own. But that's what happens in the beginning discussion when you're talking about doing this in the first place.
Representative Wall has a question, and Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like a lot of these programs may not be redundant, but are more additive. In other words, a 4-week, 5-week, 6-week, 8-week. You can start with, you can keep adding and getting different certificates, or some have like dental assisting, CT1, CT2, associate's degree. So I imagine you could continue on and add more classes and get a higher level certificate or diploma or degree. It's not necessarily that they're redundant, they're just, it's just like adding more things onto a pizza. It doesn't mean you should only sell one kind of pizza. In other words, you can keep adding stuff on it and improve your degree.
and you're still taking a lot of the same courses. I mean, by listing them all separately, it looks like they're all duplicates up there. Some may just be adding a few more classes on, is that right?
It's possible they are duplicates. This is just a small amount. We could have made a whole lot more slides than just these. So this is just a taste, just to show you that there's a lot of things going on, and it's just time to make that kind of evaluation. And I think that some may just be additional so that you're able to do more things in your job, and others may have just changed one part of it, and they call it something different. But that's part of the review that's necessary to be able to do. And this is what I was trying to do on this example, is it's not just from within the university system, but you have a lot of training schools out there outside of the university system that are still public as well as private ones. And it's going to take bringing everybody to the table to get the best programs for the betterment of Alaskans. This was just a taste, so
yep.
You know, was it maybe like going and trying to figure out each one of those in the small amount of time we have here today?
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having a hard time understanding why AFTEC is, why you perceive that AFTEC is not doing their job. They're, from what I understand, every single student that gets out of AFTEC has a job. There are jobs that are going unfilled because AFTEC is too small of a program, and I understand there's a bill somewhere to eliminate the AFTEC program. Nursing training has greatly expanded in this state in the last 20 years. Healthcare is a growth industry. We need to be providing more in-state nurses. Same thing with teaching. We've increased the number of teachers that we're producing, but 80% of our new teachers still come from outside. I think we have a problem in terms of making teaching in the state more attractive and keeping and getting those teachers to stay in state and teach in our schools. That's a bigger problem than actually training teachers. Did I hear you say that this consolidation effort was modeled on something from Georgia?
Nobody has said AFTEC wasn't doing their job. I'm just saying AFTEC also provides other things that are now being competed.
My question was about basing this consolidation effort on something from the state of Georgia.
I wanted to take care of the comments that you did, and I will also answer that. Yes, Georgia did some consolidation. North Dakota has done some. Georgia's just the most recent one, so we were able to just kind of take their framework and look at how it would be able to work here. We made a lot of changes to what they did because our system's a lot different than Georgia. But I also want to make a correction that AFTEC is doing their job. If you took that, I said that they didn't. They absolutely do. My comment for AFTEC was, and I'll give you an example. I just saw a thing from the University of Alaska talking about using, working with Marines, adding some more things to do with the Marine Highway and pilots and those. AFTEC right now has like the number one program in that field. My question to the university, are you starting something now that's going to directly compete with AFTEC, which is also, in my opinion, a state school? We do a lot of funding toward it. And if so, is it because they're not able to take all the students that they have to do all the training, or have you just found an opportunity to make money and now we're going to split it up and have two smaller programs? My point is that we're doing a lot of things. Are we doing it the best that we can? Are we competing within our own system for the same child and pulling them, you know, two directions versus having one of the best programs in that area? And that's what I've seen more and more happening is that we've had good programs, and now we have a state, whether it's a training program or a university doing it, offering exactly the same thing, and the classes aren't growing. They're actually shrinking because we're taking that 20 students that were attending this program, and then we've got 5 here and 5 here and 10 there, which now I have to have 3 instructors instead of maybe one elite instructor to be able to do that. So it's really trying to make it to where we have the best training for whatever program our students, whether they're just coming out of high school or maybe they want to shift their careers to be able to do. And when you have a lot of money, things tend to grow, programs tend to grow, and we're not as diligent as we normally would be if there isn't as much money. So again, this is a concept. It's something that I think that could be a very big benefit to our students, you know, both for the university and for our training centers. And then also it'll be easier for her to look at and say, okay, why are we not training more in this area? Because we have a great program and not as many students can get into. So how do we make that happen? It's really about opportunities and looking at everything. So all the answers aren't here, and this is just kind of a 10,000-foot level. We're going to be delving into this a lot more on the subcommittee, and we invite anybody even in this committee who would like to participate, because it's going to be a roundtable discussion, because there are many pieces to it, and at the end of the day, if it's a policy change, it comes from here, not from our subcommittee. Our subcommittee is more looking at the financial benefits from it, and basically recommendations we could see to the regions of those they could be looking during the interim. But you'll see where we can see a little bit more of the savings that doesn't have anything to do with this consolidation portion here.
Mr. Chair, well, if I could finally get to my question, I would appreciate it. Is there quantitative evidence on how these reforms would affect student retention and completion of programs?
Mr. Representative Drummond, I can look at Georgia, their retention, which is much higher than what ours is. And you'll see a slide coming up here that will show the graduation rate at each one of our universities, and sadly enough, they were very low. So, you know, in my opinion, this could only help us go up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, reform is a continuous process. And I was on the task force in higher education 6 years ago, and we addressed some of these questions. And we need to readdress them again. And I'm very happy that, the finance subcommittee is bringing forward to us. And hopefully what we'll get is some of the reports from the university about the avoidance of duplication of courses and how many degrees they've taken off of the list that they offered and those kind of things. That's the information we need back, and I want to make sure it's not seen that my comments here are seen as something that is saying that we don't need to be addressing these things. So I just want to, because it sometimes seems adversarial when we're asking questions, but it's not meant in that way at all. So I just want to,
Representative Seaton, I really appreciate that, and I, you know, that's a good comment. The Board of Regents, like it or not, I mean, we have a situation where everybody in the state of Alaska is having to look at cuts, you know, and the Board of Regents, I know, is sincere in looking for those cuts, but just like anything, especially in government, we tend to get lazy, you know. I'm not accusing the university of that. I think that's just a something that plagues us all, and they're evaluating this and they're working on it, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward so we can think about it, because I'm old-fashioned enough to think that the legislature ought to be involved somehow. You know, as I understand it, I'm not sure the numbers exactly, but the budget from the University of Alaska was an increase that the regents approved for this coming year. And to me, there's a disconnect there, you know, and so we've got to look at this stuff. We have to bring these things on the table, and it makes it easier for the Board of Regents. If they see us talking these policy things, I think it just makes better interaction for all of us when we get to the end product better. So, again, thank you, and thank you for your comment.
Could I?
Yeah, Representative
Filson. Mr. Chairman, I'm a guest here, and I appreciate you indulging this. And I would echo what Representative Seaton said. There's no great harm that would come through going through this exercise, but there are going to be folks that you know, see this data differently or want new data. One thing I did want to address, because, and I'd forgotten this, was your first point this morning, and you sort of mentioned it again, sort of obliquely, but the idea of specialization. One thing I am pretty confident about is, although, for example, the example that comes to mind, there are 10 branches of the UC system, University of California system, 10 towns, if you will, 10 campuses. UC Davis and UC Berkeley are well known to have perhaps the two better law schools, along with UCLA, maybe. But be watchful about the idea that there's not enough talent in the professorial ranks. There is plenty. I mean, my brother is a professor, PhD of political science on the East Coast. There are generally, he told me, 200 applicants, all with PhDs, vying for a single position. So we can find good professors for our major campuses. That's not going to be a concern. I really, truly believe that that's true. There's not going to be a dearth of talent so that we've got to send everyone to Anchorage. That isn't going to be an issue, I think.
Yeah. Thanks for addressing that. Let's try to limit to questions, because we're getting to this part about the graduation rate and the dollars per campus and all that. I'm sure that we'll all be very engaged here.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, most of these ideas They could take all of them. They could take some of them. Again, it's just putting everything on the table to say, you know, these are some ways to make some changes and have more services in time when we don't have as much funding versus just chopping up programs. And, you know, we put the regents, who we put very good people in those positions, to make those types of decisions. So, and again, I want to make sure, as we talk about Georgia, they did it in pods. So it's not that they didn't put all of their universities underneath one. It's probably very similar, more similar to what California's doing. So it kind of just gave you another idea to take care of some of the, you know, concerns that we have heard from students and faculties as well. Okay, so so we'll provide greater access to workforce-oriented degrees, and these are just some examples that we are seeing some collaboration already going on. So UAF Regional Campus, the Bristol Bay Campus, partners with UAA School of Nursing to provide local residents opportunities to gain degrees in nursing to provide local employment. So this kind of goes on the point to where they don't necessarily have to go anywhere. They've done a partnership between one of the major campuses and one of the smaller areas. Another one, a coordinating approach. UA is developing and improving programs in partnership with Alaska's maritime industry to build a skilled and qualified workforce. This point here just, you know, brought the concern I was bringing up while ago, is that maritime is one of the very excellent programs that AFTAC does. Is University of Alaska, and we'll be asking them this question, are they offering this because, again, as Representative Drummond kind of brought up, are the classes full and we've got a big wait list? Or is this just another way that we're competing that we don't necessarily have to do? I don't know the answer to that question. We'll be happy to discuss that more in our subcommittee meetings. Increase economic development across Alaska through enhanced degree programs, community partnerships, and improved student completion. Build on existing collaboration between the university systems. Streamline administrative services while improving service levels. I have a slide coming up that will show you just how heavy we are on the administrative side. Consolidate institutions will merge functions and leadership positions. And inefficient and complex reporting relationships can be avoided. Potential for improving administrative efficiencies and yielding net savings. Again, I have a slide that'll do this. So I've just gone back to the bottom of this, just showing you what we currently have through Anchorage, Fairbanks, Southeast, and then statewide. So we have a chancellor that heads each university center and reports to the president. And each university center possesses multiple levels of administrative services, including vice presidents, vice chancellors, associate vice chancellors, deans, associate deans, special assistants, provosts, directors, and athletic coach three. All regional university centers have extended community campus sites across the state. So that's what we have currently going on. So this is starting to get into a little bit more about where we can start streamlining our costs without impacting our students. The average compensation for executive positions at the University of Alaska in 2014 was $257,778. 58 employees make more than $208,000 per year, equaling $14.1 million. And just to put it in perspective, the governor of Alaska makes $145,000 per year. So these are the total of the 58 employees, and I didn't name anybody, but just the position there. But this kind of gives you an idea, you know, and these are in the statewide. These are not individuals sitting at the universities themselves, totaling the $14 million. Again, you know, can we look at these and say, is there a possibility that any of this could be streamlined? Question, you know, you also have professors on here too. Sometimes we hear they don't get the pay. They have an average salary on this level of $225,258
apiece. Mr. Chairman, that can't be right. That number simply cannot be a correct number. And I'd like that checked.
President Josephson?
Yes.
You will notice it comes out of their book. I will be more happy to copy the page for you and bring it to your office later today.
So, thank you. If I may. So your position is that a tenured professor in salary makes over $200,000?
Through the chair, President Josephson, these 12 that are sitting on the statewide make that salary.
Fine.
These
great.
12 positions, not every professor, right. I'm sure, makes that amount of money.
Okay. Thank you.
That question is on the record, and
I see Chris back there with his head down. He's not going to look up.
No, he's not. This is a question on the record, and we will be dealing with it. Representative
and Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that the header is recognized there. That's not salary, that's total cost.
That's what I just will say, yes, that's total compensation as well, which would be health insurance, all the others that go with it.
And Mr. Chairman,
oh, Representative Siegel.
If I could, one of the questions that I had coming into this, and I'm posing it for the university to come back and answer for us, is the reform of the optional retirement and whether they've gotten rid of that or reformed it. It was something that became hugely expensive, and I don't know if it terminated the program or not, but we'll want to find that out, because that was tied to the TERS level of reimbursements. And a few years ago, when we took over TERS, that percentage went up, and so all of a sudden that plan was being funded at a huge rate. And I want to make sure that that program is terminated. And so a specific cost saving measure that I wanted to put on the table, optional retirement plan report, whether it is subcommittee.
And just to remind people that on most of the slides that we have, you can look at the bottom, and it does have where the sources came from. We didn't have enough time to make these things up. We want to make sure that people knew where to find those. And again, it's those, you know, when we're talking about these positions, these are up in the statewide level. This is not everyone. This was the 12 positions that were listed on the specific ones, not for every instructor in the university system.
If I could make a request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, I want to thank you for bringing some of these topics up, because these aren't easy things to bring up, and you may not make a lot of friends. But I had a couple questions. Do you know, or can you find out, sort of the proportion of admin costs in relation to, say, the student body, or I don't know what you'd measure it against. As the university grew over the last, you know, decade or more, did admin costs grow proportionally or more than proportionally, if you understand my question?
Mr. Chairperson, I do understand your question. We'll make sure we have that for our subcommittee.
Yeah, I'm just curious if admin grew faster than the rest of the university, or and obviously by consolidating, like if two companies merge, you often eliminate double management. So I imagine that some of the consolidation you're talking about is to eliminate some of the upper management. I'm guessing that's part of the goal.
Sure, so we'll walk right to the next slide. That's exactly what it shows. So the digital savings is $3,424,531. It's all these executive positions, again, you know, we're two associate deans of faculty instead of four, three deans of academics instead of seven. And I'm not saying this is the number it should be. This is just if it were, you know, this is how we came up with $3.4 million. One provost instead of two, you can be the list as you go down. Like I said, you know, these will be discussions that we will be having at a roundtable meeting. Again, that's how we're going to hold our meetings this year, whereas cooperation between the whole group, instead of kind of having somebody on a hot seat and just kind of firing questions at them, not that this isn't fun. So, but again, like I said, you know, is there a way that we can streamline it, as Representative Wolf said, the administrative services, and looking at that, because, you know, in my aspect, but the university has raised tuition, and they're probably getting pretty close to topping out to where it can. It may come down to economics that our students decide to go somewhere else instead of staying here. Well, this is for the higher education payment levels, and you'll see again where we got this from. Of all the states listed on this slide, Alaska has the lowest retention rate, 63.3, a first-time college freshman returning for a second year of college. That's what this one shows. Our closest regional neighbor, Washington, has a 17% higher retention rate than Alaska. This needs to be improved in Poland, which I think we can all agree that. Once the more of our students come back until they actually get a degree or a certificate, whatever they want. Okay, so now we're going to get into the charts in which it shows us our graduation rates. It does it by the University of Alaska Anchorage. The University of Anchorage campus, and the system would be all the ones that we saw earlier, plus the University of Alaska on it. This comes from there in Fairbanks. University itself, and then all of the campuses together combined. And as you see, as a system as a whole, we have a law that we can definitely, you know, improve upon.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Joseph.
I don't know what these statistics mean. I mean, I have to take, if I may, through the chair, I have to take to renew my teaching certificate, which expires next year, 6 credits, and I'm going to do it. But I'm not getting a degree. So I'm not going to graduate with a degree. I'm just going in there to take a couple of classes.
Representative Joseph, through the chair, as you'll see at the bottom, these statistics here, again, just a part of the university, is counting full-time freshmen based on a 3-year graduation rate for 2 years or less programs. We're talking about associate's degrees as well as, we're not talking about endorsements where you just have to go back and take 3 or 6 hours to do that, or maybe a refresher course for this. We're talking about freshmen coming in and coming back the second year. So this is not every student that comes into the university.
Just to follow up, what do you know about whether they are transferring to Harvard after their freshman year?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, I don't know that. This comes from the university in their numbers, but I have a hard time believing, and I could be incorrect, that 86% of our students are going somewhere else after the first year.
Okay.
But again, that'll be a question I'm sure that the university will want to answer as they ask somebody.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you note at the bottom, just for clarification, these are associate degrees, certificates, or occupational endorsements. These are not 4-year graduating.
Right, you're right. The next slide has our next one.
Right, but the one thing that we need to do is, especially like when we compare ourselves nationwide, almost every other system in every other state has 2 systems, one a community college system and one a university system. So you have 2 years and 4 years, and ours is a combination. So when you look at those rates, you also have to remember that we are talking about those people that are taking some courses that don't go on to a 4-year, never intended to go to a 4-year. So on our national accreditation or national rate of graduation, we actually have to make sure we understand that as well. So I'm not knocking that, but
I just want I just want to put on record. I don't, and a clarification, but I don't see anything about 4-year. In other words, if we're talking occupational endorsement, it may be a 2-year program, and the completion rate would still be valid even if it was 2 or 4 years. As I look at that, I don't see anything. Am I right?
Mr. Chairman, this is 1 and 2-year programs. I'm sorry, the next slide will have our 4-year programs on it. So this is 1 or 2 years. And like I said, this is just the data that we see from the university. We'll get more specifics on it. One question I know that has been asked many times on the subcommittee as well as in finance is, you know, what's happening? A lot of what we hear is, and I hope that maybe there'll be time for this committee at some point to bring the university president together and the commissioner of education. Because I know we've heard, and I know Representative Seaton, who's been here longer than I have, and Representative Keller, that they're high school students are not coming out with the education that they need. Well, my question is, why not? And what is the university doing to see where those deficiencies were? With today's technology, we know where our students are coming from. They're coming from out of state, where they're coming from, and hopefully somebody is doing those statistics, because they'll say, I'll use Fairbanks, and I'm going to say this, is not like Fairbanks, so this is nothing against that. But let's just say that most of the students came for whatever reason, had to take extra courses in math before they could go and take the course that actually counts for credit. I would hope the university would go back to Fairbanks and say, for some reason this year, you know, 15% of the students came and ended up having to take an additional math course. Can we sit down and look at what your math books look like and what these students in particular, I mean, they can't tell us because of confidentiality, but that's something the districts could have together and say, oh, I see, so somehow the way this is being explained, or maybe it's not in the book and we expect it to be on the college level. Those are some of the real discussions, I think, that could even over the consolidation portion of it, can improve both our high school graduation, and first-time university students that come in. I think you'll see a lot of these and the ones that we have for the bachelor, that probably the biggest reason people drop out at that first level is because they just don't do very well, for whatever reason. Maybe it's a change from the community, maybe they didn't have the background that they needed, and maybe they just decided they got a better job somewhere else. There's all reasons that they couldn't do it, but my concern on these are pretty low numbers. And I think we should be concerned and get more information from the university to find out, you know, and you can look at different campuses and how much they range as well when you're looking at the bachelor's degrees. And a question, a fair question to the university is, when someone doesn't come back, and if they went to Harvard or they went somewhere else, those are pretty easy because those students who are going out of state are going to ask for their transcripts, believe me, to be transferred, so they get every credit that they can. The group that we're concerned about is ones that don't ask for it to be done, and are we doing any kind of follow-up to see what's going on and how we can possibly get it there? Because in private business, if you start losing business, you've got a team that's trying to figure out why are they going to the competitor and what can we do to bring them back. And we may be needing to do the same thing.
And Mr. Chairman, I think the record here, at least on slide 31, is pretty clear that at UAF, for example, the trend line and overall is going very nicely. Thank you.
One of the reasons we split the slides was to show kind of a better basis of comparison. We did a two-year slide and a four-year slide, so you can somewhat look at it and say this is how it compares to a, say, a two-year program at community colleges, and then you got the four-year program. I also have some data on here in the footnotes that have the national average for a two-year program. And I believe it's 19%, 19.5% in FY15. Nationwide three-year graduation rate of associate and certificates seeking at a public institution, which is significant. I mean, it's quite a bit higher than most of the figures on that slide. We have a 16.8 there at the bottom, but everything else is quite a bit lower. So just a little basis for comparison.
So 3% is what you said.
Yep. On the highest figure we have on the slide, yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I think even 19% is pretty low. So I think we have a lot of the whole point of the slide really is that, again, you know, we're getting students through the door. Why are they not completing? And it could be a lot of different reasons why they are not completing, but at least you have the customers there. So it's not like we have to go out and look for new customers. How can we complete those that we already have as we're looking for new ones as well?
I would like to interject too, but I don't really see a trend there, because the year before we had the 16.8. We had the 13.9. And 2 years before that, it was 15.1. So I kind of see a lot of ups and downs there, and maybe we would need a couple of years more data of an upward trend before I would consider that a trend, in my opinion.
This just shows you, the potential increase if 10% of those were able to. So a potential savings to the state, a student retention could be improved 10 and 20%. We believe that the university consolidation will result in increased student retention due to many aspects associated with the consolidation itself, not least of which are the clear and consistent course requirements and degree pathways, as well as the ability of the student to transfer between
Mr. Chairman,
the 10% increase, are you just saying that the population in each university or in each degree will increase by, if we have 20% more kids go stay in the university because they've stayed there and an additional group came in and we expanded the university by 20% of student population, is that the bottom figure? I mean, but if we retain 20% more, that means with the incoming class being the same size, the increase is going to be 20% more students. Is that what we're looking at?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this data was gathered basically. I took the number of bachelor's degrees issued in those years, the number of associate's degrees issued in those years. Assuming 10 and 20% increase, and with the bachelor's degree multiply them by 4, and the associate's degree multiply by 2, based on a graduating class representing a 4-year program and a graduating class representing a 2-year program, and just multiply the numbers out. So this data was taken directly off of a UA Review 2015, which is just a paper essentially that the university puts out on their numbers of degrees issued. So that's how I extrapolated that data, was just taking the numbers of degrees, the years taken to get that degree on average, and then did the math out at a 10 to 20% increase of retention. And they're not exact, obviously, because there's some people finish a degree slightly earlier, some people take slightly longer, but it kind of gives you an idea of potential increases that we could obtain from that. If that is, did I answer your question there, Representative?
I understand that, but I just, it seems like, I mean, we don't make money on students. And so we would gain money, but if we put 20% more bodies in the classroom, if we expand our university by 20%, these savings are assuming that we don't hire any more, that we're going to have 20% more students and not hire any more professors or have any more expenses, as I'm understanding it. I just...
Through the chair, you're correct. All we did at this point is that, and we didn't count students who are coming in, this is just that they were able to keep those who didn't make it to the very end. The other that this doesn't take into account either is out of state. We used in state, so this was the lower amount. But yes, you're correct. If we would end up having to have more professors or more labs and more, that could be able to increase. But also, it could be that it would just fill the classrooms up in the full. So it would depend upon what degrees that we're talking about. The biggest concern is that our rates are low, and if we can bring those up, you know, I think it's not just about the money that we would bring in, but hopefully students completing, getting better jobs, if we know that most do through training programs or through the university.
It's a valuable slide in this very general sense. It has an impact, a funding impact when the there's no completion. What that exactly is, we don't know.
And Mr. Chair, and it's kind of back to, you know, since we're talking about most of this happens between the first year and the second year through that transition. We're hoping that through a clear and consistent course requirements and degree pathways, as well as the ability of the student to transfer between the different campuses without losing valuable credits. Remember that losing credits represents a loss of time and money that can be frustrated to a student making a decision whether or not they want to stay in or not. We're hoping that through some of the consolidation concepts that we will see, this will be another positive that could happen. Again, you know, until you start down the process, well, you know what things will work and what won't work. What works in one area may not necessarily do on the other. But again, like I said, this would just be based on in-state tuition. You also have out-of-state, and then as Representative Seaton pointed out, you know, we did put in all the factors because we don't know what the ability of each one, whether or not more professors would have to be there. So this wasn't just for me about the money, but it was also about helping students be able to complete what they're doing. So what are the challenges? So you see, you know, we looked at both sides. We didn't just say it was all rosy, you know, from here on. Again, blending with institutional cultures, there's been a lot through the years that historic and sometimes unhealthy competition between Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau has led to distinct university cultures of pride, which has led to disunion within the University of Alaska. So as you try to be individualized, there are good things about being individualized, but there are also sometimes, you know, we put walls up and without sharing information or more or less competing. And we don't want to see a system competing with each other. We want them building each other up and having the best for our children. The regional universities currently have different branding and marketing strategies. All those would have to be looked at, and whether or not they want to be how distinct from each other they wanted to stay, or they might have one mission statement, one branding, one marketing, and be talking about how the University of Alaska is versus each one of the campuses. So I think, you know, you have different kind of competitions, different positives, and negatives to it. So this is our first slide, Mr. Chair, that kind of goes a little bit into the budget issue. And we just want to point out one thing. This is something we're going to look into seriously. We have a miscellaneous component here that in the 2006 management plan was at $4,358,000, and now it's at $17,361,298%. I can't give you an explanation because that's one of those things that we want you to come join our committee and find out. Travel, as you'll see, $18 million has gone to $19 million. It's not a big increase, but it's that $18 million through, you know, since 2006 to now. You know, that shows there must be some type of efficiencies because I know travel has become more expensive, yet it seems like that has somewhat stabilized grants, benefits. And again, this is just kind of giving you an idea to kind of have heard it going back to a certain year, what would it matter, what would it mean compared to where we are now? It just kind of shows you those different amounts.
Thank you, Chair. Looking at these numbers, you're going back 10 years and comparing different, same category of expenses.
We have to start from somewhere.
Adjusted for inflation, I assume?
Through the Chair, no. These are the actual numbers that they're currently, what were in 2006 management plan, and then the 2016 management plan, and then what's being proposed by the Governor.
So travel on this went up $1 million, but adjusted for inflation, it probably went down. Am I correct?
Did the Chair represent what? I would think if you put inflation in it, that could be possible.
Or is that
transportation? Well, I guess my next question is, this miscellaneous, is this something you know and you're not going to tell us till we go to your next meeting, or is it is this like a secret prize, or is this just been categorized as miscellaneous and who knows what was there now, what was there 10 years ago?
To Chair Rex, well, I didn't make the miscellaneous category that actually came out of the book. At this point, I honestly don't know. I will know if by the time we have our first meeting what it is, but no one gives away all their secrets at one meeting.
Thank you, through the Chair. Just on the inflation issue, yesterday it was interesting at the Alaska Oil and Gas Association luncheon, they noted that in the last 16 years, not 10, but a little more, 16, their costs to produce oil have grown by 90%. So I know that that's oil equipment and this is not oil equipment, but just wanted to make that point. Were you aware that Ms. Pitney tells me, of course, she ran UAF's sort of treasury or something. She was CFO, I guess. She tells me that as a proportion of the total, roughly $900 million, the state contribution has shrunk. Now, I don't know over what number of years, but it's obviously over $300 million now, so very, very approximately a third, a little more than a third, I guess. But that number has gone down as the university has found its own resources through federal funding, grants, tuition, et cetera. Is that an important statistic that we should look at as well?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I am so glad we're on that committee. But yeah, it has shrunk down. The question is, you know, was it loaded to start with, which is one thing that we need to look at. Mm-hmm. I know then Representative Faircloth, who now is Senator McKinnon, when she had the subcommittee for the university, she then started matching how much public funds were going to match how much the university raised and trying to get it almost to a dollar for a dollar. And that's when you started seeing some of that shrink down as it wasn't based on necessary performance, but it was based on how much the university raised and how much it was. I think we need to be focused on the money, but I think what bringing forward the consolidation issue was more, are there things that we could be smarter about? Use better service that will save us money in the run versus just saying, I think we should give them $30 million less or $100 million less. You know, we kind of have a unique position when it comes to the university, and I guess I should have brought this up to start with, Mr. Chair. When we do the university, we give them, as a legislature, an amount of money. Unlike most departments where we'll go through each one of the departments and go through each allocation and say, you know, we think more money needs to go here or less money goes here. Right now, we don't do that with the university. The university, we give the regents a set amount of money, and we may give them guidance and say we want to see it here, and that's something we will go for a subcommittee to give you the breakdown of where we thought the money should come from and what actually did happen. But in reality, they are able to go in any direction that they want to go, unless the committee would decide to go down to, you know, six or seven allocations, which was done a few years ago. But at this point, we give them one sum, the region can determine where they want to be able to put it. Does that answer your question, Representative Justin?
All of those are relevant, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Grumman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The line that says grants, comma, benefits near the bottom, I assume you want grants to increase. That's not money that's coming from the state. But why are benefits included in the grants line?
To the Chair, Representative Drummond, this is not my chart. This is a chart right out of the budget book.
I see.
And they combine that. We don't.
Okay. So you don't know what that means.
You will be on the committee. We will have all that broken down for you. We'd be happy to send it to you if you're unable to make it. But this was just kind of giving you an idea, just out of the book, putting, you know, apples to apples. You know, this is, you know, how what's listed into each one of those, and those are the details that we'll be going through starting next week. So I just kind of wanted to put some of those numbers that were, you know, out there for you to kind of give you an idea of what we're doing. Just kind of a review of why we even looked at the consolidation portion of that. It was obviously driven by money. It was also driven from last year. Last year was the first year I had a university budget. I mean, how do you even start as a legislator, you know, on a 10,000-foot level of looking at something as massive as a university? It's not just about teaching, as President Josephson has said. It's not just about research. And then you've got the third component, and that's the community service, what they do for the communities that they're in. So every decision that we'll make, not just with the university, but throughout all the budgets, will affect communities in different ways. So there are ways that we can save money and still keep a lot of the services within that. Is why I thought it was important that we look at other options that other states did when they were in a financial situation. And again, you know, a slight review creates unified pathways to obtain degrees and certificates, providing a clear and concise direction, making it so that we can transfer credits easily, where e-learning, if that's what we wanted to do as a student, I would be able to do that. I wouldn't necessarily have to pick a university major to start with, because I knew that at least my first 2 years were going to transfer easily right into the other. Strengthening unified academic departments to provide program opportunities across Alaska while increasing proficiency and student service, and creating a modern university that balances access, research, and public service. And I'd just like to close, Mr. Chair. First, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. This isn't popular to do. But, you know, that is our job. That's what we ran on, is that we were going to look at these hard situations and understanding everything on the table that we possibly can. Again, this is not a criticism of the university. There are just a lot of options out there. And a lot of, and with every option comes an opportunity that will only, in my opinion, strengthen the university, have more graduates, and overall, Alaskans are the ones that gain the most. Thank you very much.
Everyone see?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is really great that we're having this context within the education committee as well. I serve on the university budget committee, and last year we were really delving into some of these administrative layers. And, you know, we're in, but really about the crunch time. Last year we were talking about trying to figure out how to go in and say, okay, you have to eliminate so many of these layers of, you know, deputy dean, assistant deans, and all those things, because they're expensive, and it's good to see some numbers here, estimates of what could be potential savings, although those may or may not be the right positions, just looking at that, and I hope hopefully the university will come back with that. One other issue besides the optional retirement plan portion that will probably be there, and I just want to put it on the record here before the Education Committee, because it was before the Finance Subcommittee, was that here we've talked about education and about graduate certificate degrees, graduation rates, and everything, and yet we have a large expense within our university system of athletics. And a lot of that comes from, because we're far away from sending teams outside, and that's a lot of expense on travel, but also we are paying to import teams. Those teams that come up here, we pay for their travel up to Alaska. And so at some point in time, we are going to have to make a decision of what we feel is important for the university and what we're trying to have come out of the university. And I talked about it in the Finance Subcommittee, because when I went to University of California, Santa Barbara, the first year I went there, we had just built a new football stadium. The football players were all getting priority classes, and everybody, the student body voted to terminate football. And, you know, everybody was there. Next year, football was terminated at University of California, Santa Barbara, and never come back. And nobody missed it that was there for an education. So, you know, there are priorities, and I really appreciate the, but, you know, this is something that sometimes we get in there and say, oh, you can't have it without hockey and football. You know, we have to. And yet when you look at the number of students that are actually going to the games, you are spending a lot. And it turned out that in the Wichita conversation, there was only like five schools in the entire western United States that make money on football. On the average in the others is $1,000 per student per year is coming out of tuition and fees to pay for football programs in most universities. And the question is, do we want to have those charges laid on our students, because that's where some tuition and fees go. So, sorry for getting carried on budget stuff, but I think that is a policy issue that we have to decide of what is the purpose of the university in these tight budget times, because they are very tight. And when we start talking about, well, we got to consolidate and cut out nursing at two universities, but we're still going to be paying athletic teams to come to Alaska, paying their travel to get up here so we have somebody to compete with. That's a big question for me. So thank you for letting me stray.
No, that's why we're having the meeting. That's very good.
I think that would be great to see the actual numbers income generation versus expenditure on that. I'm from the interior, and Representative Wall and I aren't going to say we don't like Nanook hockey. And we don't think it's not an important part of the social structure in the interior. You had mentioned of how much is provided through services. But I would like to see the numbers, because I know my Nanook sweatshirt cost me about $38. I think they might make a little money off that program.
And Mr. Chairman, to Representative Talavica and to also Representative Seaton, just discussions, but briefly, just the last slides that you have back here, and we're not going to get into those because there would be no reason for you to be in front of my committee, and that is really what's important here. This breaks it down, but the fact that the numbers don't tell all the story, but what was asked by the chair was to kind of for us to just show you by graduation rate, which is kind of the only way we can judge some of these. So you'll see some high numbers at some of these lower campuses. Again, that'll be a reflection of how many students come out of it. So the first half of the slides that you'll see, the first half of the following budget review, which has green headers at the top of the slides, will reflect the total funding, as well as UGF, for the University of Alaska statewide programs, various campuses, and the UA system as a whole in a comparative chart that shows the funding levels that were authorized in the FY16, what the governor has proposed in FY17, as well as the difference between the two numbers. The second part of the review, which are the slides with the blue headers, show a breakdown of degrees, certificates of endorsement, awarded by level, and regional universities. It also lists the number and types of degrees issued per year in the different campuses, the cost per degree issued, and the Board of Regents' overall UGF funding of those campuses. The intent of the budget review is to give you a more clear understanding of the university campuses' costs, funding levels, as well as the number and types of degree, which also providing the context of where the funding levels were at last year and what the governor's plan is in FY17. And this will just provide you a more holistic financial view of the university. Again, it doesn't show you, you know, you'll see some of the numbers will look skewed as far as, now these are just the actual numbers here for the House subcommittee where we ended, what was authorized to FY16 and then FY17 in the government proposal, and then the difference between the two. What you have here is the University of Alaska Anchorage total funding and all the campuses that go with that, and the decreases from authorized 16 to FY17. And here's the numbers I was telling you, kind of, you know, you'll start seeing a little bit of difference. This is total funding, that's like 41. This is just, I'm going to say general funds on 42. And then here is what you have, degree certificates and endorsements awarded by level. And this is the University of Alaska system, and each one of those, as you'll see. These are degree certificates and endorsements awarded by level for the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, and I will be saying these for Anchorage and Fairbanks and Southeast, for also counting the small campuses, that fall underneath that we had on the first sheet. So it's not just the main campus themselves. And these are in-state and out-of-state. There's not a big change that's made. Now, hopefully, you'll start seeing, we don't have the details that we'll have in here. Cost for group rates for each university campus. And all we did was take the FY14 authorized funds, were divided by the degrees and certificates that were awarded, to come up with the cost per degree. So we kind of have an intermix of a bachelor's degree, a certificate. Some of the things cost less to do, but what we just kind of want to do is at least apples to apples of throwing all the degrees together. But some campuses, and again, we'll get more into this as we have our subcommittee, more campuses will have more certificates, and they will definitely have bachelor's, closer bachelor's, you'll see at the major universities, you'll see a lot of your associate's degrees, your certificates, as some of the smaller ones on there, and that's why I don't want to necessarily get caught up into all of the numbers, because, again, it's very, I guess, judgy. This particular year only had one person, so there was nobody else to divide it among, so that, but we kind of have to keep it, the apples on it, and, but we'll go deeper into the subcommittee of, how was that degree determined? It was just one. It might have only just even been a certificate. Most of what you'll see on a lot of these smaller campuses are a lot of online, getting their first 2 years done, getting ready to go into their third, fourth degree. So, again, because the person Stephen brought it up, we don't have the community college aspect, it does make some of these types of charts much harder to be able to explain, because we're one big campus, all measured on one level. And maybe one of the discussions that will need to take place is we used to have the community college concept and it was changed. Maybe that wasn't such a good idea. Maybe it was. As a policy call, it's not something that we'll have in our subcommittee discussed. But as we get better numbers, better understand, well, not better numbers, these are the numbers, but better understanding of what each one of these campuses do and why you would not necessarily see a graduate as in a four-year degree at some of the campuses will help us better understand how much the cost is at each one of these. But I just kind of wanted to just give an overall.
Mr. Chairman,
there's a question before you on that slide, before we leave that slide. Maybe we could ask the university to come up with, to help us understand this, some comparisons with other states on particular degrees. In other words, if we find we're paying an exorbitant amount for one particular kind of degree, maybe, it'd be wiser for us to give a scholarship to Oahu or something, for just a few students. What I'm saying is if they could come up with comparison, on the degree level, it'd be great. I know you didn't do it in this slide. But.
Mr. Chairman, I agree. And one of the reasons why you'll see the CPC, where it shows it's $15,299, I know they do a lot of certificates. They do a lot smaller degrees, so therefore there would be a lot more graduates on that level versus if we did just all, bachelor's degrees at each one of these levels. But that's going to be we'll be delving into the splitting those numbers up a little bit better. But I just wanted to pique your interest.
Yeah.
I think I did.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the first one I was going to ask was the $1 million degree from Chuck Chi, but I guess you kind of addressed that.
Right.
That sounds like a good school, I guess. Just looking at Anchorage campus and Fairbanks campus, for example, the overall budgets are pretty similar, but one has almost, 2.5 times. The cost per degree is quite different, and is that's and maybe you address this, is that because there's certificates and different kinds of degrees, say coming out of Anchorage, that Fairbanks is more four-year degrees or master's and PhDs, or is there research, and the overall budgets are about the same, that doesn't include, say, research dollars or something like that.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that information is all available, and I'd be happy to get it for you. It's the university and the budget book break down those items, and I'd be happy to get them for you.
All right, thanks.
Mr. Chairman, again, you're absolutely correct. What you say is that we've lumped anything that you got, whatever you graduated with.
Right.
We just did the rough numbers to start with, and then we're going to be working with the university to get more detailed numbers to break it up. But the biggest part we wanted to show is that it's all over the board. And again, another reason why maybe looking into consolidation in certain levels would be beneficial, and maybe we might find out like, you know, you look at Matsu right there, and you're at 39,000 versus Anchorage at 56,000. But I want to remind you, it's not just bachelor's, we've got master's degrees and doctorals as well. So this is just a very high level look of just doing the simple math of, you know, graduation based on costs that, that we had.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilson, when I look at two slides, 31 is a slide that tells me about baccalaureate degrees, and it says that, for example, the University of Alaska, most recent stat, 29% got a degree. True? Is that what that's telling me? Roughly.
Okay, what year are you?
FY14.
Entered in fall 2011. About almost, not quite a third finished a degree,
a bachelor's degree at UAA?
At the University.
Right, okay. So if I then go to slide 47, the Anchorage campus, and it says that each degree cost $56,000 per year, doesn't that number come crashing down if there's two-thirds that aren't getting a degree, they're infusing the system with tuition and funds and fees? And so the actual cost is subsidized by those students not getting degrees.
First of all, I want to make sure that you know 30 and 31 have to be added together, because they're both 30 is talking about the associate degree, certificate, and endorsements.
Okay.
And then you have the bachelor degrees and the masters and the doctors we didn't put on here because
they're right. Thank you.
You take those. No, you're absolutely right. Those who drop out help save costs for those who complete.
Okay.
If that was your question.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not our goal.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
the one thing I would note, and you could, you know, put me under oath and I'd tell you this. When I began my bachelor's degree in the fall of 1982, the cost for my tuition and room and board was $8,900 at a private college, at Whitman College in Walla Walla. That same degree, those same two things, would now be, I think it's $58,000. It's an increase of $50,000. Our students can't afford that, and so we've got to do some subsidizing, don't we, to have the university.
Absolutely. The question is, what is that number? I'm not here to say that we're going to take $300 and something million out of the university. I hope that's not what the presentation that you leave with. I hope what you leave with the presentation is we have some great opportunities to take advantage of. And in fact, if we take advantage of a lot of those, we may actually be able to continue the service level, not even just where it's at, but raise it up as we look at other areas in which, whether that's administrative, whether that's duplicative, because when it comes to training our young people, it's not just the university. We have a lot in the Department of Labor, and we have a lot of training schools. We have unions that have great apprenticeship programs. You know, we offer a lot, and maybe sometimes too much, out there to where sometimes it's hard to pick out which one it is. And people are actually paying more for it, as you just alluded to. So, you know, this presentation isn't about how much we can cut from the university. It's how can we be smarter. I mean, these are our smartest people up at the university, not just through research, but the professors that are there. Like you said, we have top-notch professors, and I think if we had and sent out an anonymous postcard and asked them for their best suggestions, we might even get ideas we've never even thought of. So, to me, it's thinking outside the box of how we cannot just provide the service we have now, but provide better service, better opportunities, especially in a group of students that weren't like us. I didn't spend that much time in front of gaming and all that other that we see our young people do now, and I think that changes the way that they learn and the kind of opportunities they want to be able to take their learning, much different than when we grew up, and sometimes it's hard for us to go to that world. And what we're trying to show here is that there are a lot of choices today. And for us not to look at each and every one of those then takes away instead of adding to the opportunities for our students. And I think that's why we're all here.
I really thank you, Representative Wilson, for making the presentation. And I say that with respect and awe. It's a, you know, we in our role as appropriators in the legislature, just looking at that level, the analogy I'm thinking about is my son is a pilot. He flies the Super Cub, and I'm often in the back seat. And commercially, when they do that, they take the stick out. It's kind of like putting Wilson in the back seat without the stick, you know. But in a sense, her and by extension us are responsible here for the crash. So it's our game. We ultimately have the appropriation role, and it's a really difficult one because it's a block grant. We don't have control over the line items in the budget, you know. So we got to know the pilot up front, you know, and what he's doing, and what we're doing here is taking a close look. And it's really something that is critical, and we got to do it. I made reference earlier to the sledgehammer. We have the, you know, we have the power to cut the block grant, but boy, everybody in Alaska, we're proud of our university, but we just have to remember that it was built. There's only 700,000 of us, and it was built in very prosperous times. And when the money starts going away, which we're in the situation right now, we've got to do this. We've got to look at it, and we've got to work with the regents. We've got to work with the university. No matter how bad we frustrate them, no matter how bad they frustrate us, because to maintain, like we said, we look for opportunities to make the system move possibly in. So pride in our university system will go up, not down. But again, thank you. That was a kind of long-winded thank you. But with that, we're going to gavel out at 10:47.